Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, January 3rd, 2026.
And this edition is, it's really a study in shocks and shifts. We're seeing major changes across the board.
We really are. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'll be your guide as we break this all down for you.
And I'm Sam Aster. I'm here to unpack the data, you know, get into the implications behind these headlines.
And our goal for you, the listener, is to really cut through all that noise. We want to get to the why and the how of what's happening.
Right. So you're not just informed, you're genuinely ahead of the curve.
That's the mandate. So let's jump straight in. Page one is a mix of corporate earthquakes and, unfortunately, profound human tragedy.
Yeah, let's start with the big one.
The definitive headline shock. A real corporate and, I think, geopolitical earthquake. The end of Tesla's reign in the electric vehicle industry.
That's right. For the first time, Tesla has officially lost that crown as the top global seller of EVs.
It's a huge moment. For years, analysts said Tesla's scale, its technology, was basically unbeatable. But now the crown belongs to China's BYD.
And this isn't just, you know, a minor dip in a quarterly report. The data here shows that Tesla is facing some really systemic headwinds. We're talking about annual vehicle delivery declines for the second year in a row.
A second year. That's not a blip. That's a pattern. So, looking at the final numbers for 2025, what was the specific point of failure here? Was it price? Was it competition finally catching up? Or something else?
Well, it was a mix of everything, really. But the numbers tell a pretty stark story. For the full year, 2025, Tesla's sales were down 9%.
9% for all year.
Yeah, and it got much worse in the fourth quarter. In Q4, sales dropped a staggering 16% compared with the year prior.
Wow.
So their total for 2025 was 1.64 million vehicles. Now, compare that to BYD.
Okay.
BYD sold 2.26 million battery electric vehicles. That's up 28% from 2024.
So that gap is what? Over 600,000 vehicles? That's massive.
It's a huge gap. And investors, you know, they reacted immediately. Tesla shares slumped almost 2.6% on Friday.
And the paper says that marks seven straight sessions of declines.
Right. Their longest losing streak in over a year. It's a clear sign of some serious investor anxiety of where the company's headed.
Let's talk about the domestic side of this. In the U.S., the fourth quarter drop seems directly tied to policy, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The expiration of that federal $7,500 tax rebate was a huge factor.
Right.
You saw this predictable surge in Q3 as buyers rushed to get the deal before it disappeared.
And then the floor just dropped out in Q4.
Exactly. The Journal quotes an analyst saying there was no special incentive, and boom, sales plummeted 16%. It just shows you how sensitive the American consumer still is to these subsidies.
And on the other side of that coin, you have the competition. It's not just BYD, is it? It seems like even BYD's growth is slowing down a bit.
That's the really critical nuance here. BYD took the crown, yes, but its own sales growth slowed down.
Which points to
an incredibly intense, hyper-competitive market, especially in China. They're not just fighting Tesla anymore. They're fighting domestic rivals like Geely.
And Geely's numbers are huge.
Staggering. They increased their EV production by 39% last year. And then you've got smaller players like Leapmotor, who hit their 500,000 unit target early. This isn't a two-horse race anymore. It's a global brawl, and Tesla is clearly getting squeezed.
So if that traditional EV market is getting so hostile, Elon Musk is clearly looking for an escape route. The paper pivots directly from that story to his next big bet.
Yeah, and it's a huge pivot, almost a philosophical one. He's betting Tesla's future value isn't in cars anymore.
It's in the Optimus humanoid robot and the autonomous cybercab.
Exactly. He's told investors this could generate, and this is a quote, infinite revenue. The vision is, well, it's immense. An army of humanoids that could eliminate poverty and work as we know it. Maybe even help colonize Mars.
That is the vision. But the paper does a great job of grounding us in the, let's say, the much clunkier current reality.
The current reality is very grounded, you're right. Optimus is very much still in the R&D phase. During public demos, like the one in Berlin, the robot is often just being teleoperated.
So it's not autonomous. There's a person behind the curtain.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You've got an engineer in a complex bodysuit and a VR headset basically puppeteering it. To get one bot to do a simple task in public takes a whole team, one person operating it, another running diagnostics on a laptop, others just watching for safety.
That's a lot of manpower just to fold a t-shirt. What's the fundamental technical hurdle they can't get over yet?
It really comes down to the hands. Dexterity. the engineers are struggling to create a hand that has the same, you know, sensitivity and dexterity as a human's.
And it's not just the hardware, right? It's the software, the AI controlling it.
Exactly. It's about perceiving the environment,
yeah,
dealing with unexpected things. Until these robots can handle unpredictable tasks on their own, getting them to do something genuinely useful in a factory or a home is still a long way off.
So given that huge gap between the grand vision and the current reality, how is the investment community even supposed to value this part of Tesla?
They are struggling. I mean, how do you price an industry that doesn't really exist yet? Even a big Tesla bull like ARK Invest, they just excluded Optimus entirely from their 2029 model. They don't see it being commercially viable until later.
But the potential is still massive, which is why the gamble is still on the table.
Right. Morgan Stanley's analyst predicts the entire humanoid robotics industry could hit $7.5 trillion in annual revenue by 2050.
$7.5 trillion.
So if Tesla captures even a tiny fraction of that, it completely transforms the company. The analogy of the paper is perfect. The car is to Tesla what the book was to Amazon.
It was just the first step, a way to perfect the underlying tech for the real prize.
Exactly. The real prize is AI and robotics.
We have to turn now to the other major page one story. A truly devastating human tragedy out of Switzerland.
Yeah, the fire in Crans, Montana on New Year's Day. The scale of it is just horrifying.
It happened at a bar called Le Constellation, popular with young people. The numbers are just awful. At least 40 people killed, 119 injured.
And the investigation is pointing very strongly to accidental negligence. It seems it was caused by incandescent candles and sparklers attached to champagne bottles.
A celebration that just went horribly, horribly wrong, and those sparks hit a particular material.
Yes, that's the key detail. Officials believe the sparks ignited acoustic foam on the ceiling. And that kind of foam, it burns incredibly fast and releases toxic smoke. The fire spread so quickly that people just couldn't get out.
It created a bottleneck at the entrance.
A fatal one.
Yeah.
And the victims were mostly young people, teenagers, young adults. The legal drinking age for beer and wine there is 16, so the place would have been filled with local teens and tourists.
And the aftermath sounds like pure chaos, with families desperately searching for their kids.
It does. The paper highlights the story of Umberto Marcucci, whose 16-year-old son, Manfredi, was severely burned.
He drove him to Milan for treatment himself, right?
He did. The local hospital was completely overwhelmed. He found his son just walking outside a cinema, dazed, with burns on 30 to 40% of his body. So he coordinated with Italian officials and drove his son and two other victims all the way to a specialized burn unit in Milan.
Just an unbelievable story of a father's desperation.
His son is now in a medically induced coma, but the father said, "It's a miracle he is alive. Death struck randomly." It's just chilling.
And now the legal scrutiny is going to be intense.
Oh, absolutely. The investigation is going to focus on those safety gaps. The materials used, especially that foam, the fire safety measures, whether the bar was over its capacity. If they find criminal liability, people could be facing charges for homicide and bodily harm caused by negligence.
A terrible, terrible reminder of how quickly things can go wrong.
Truly tragic.
From that, we have to pivot to a very different kind of battle, one being fought in the American pantry. It sounds almost trivial by comparison, but for corporate survival, it's just as fierce. The mac and cheese wars.
It's a perfect case study, really. It shows how these old, untouchable brands like Kraft mac and cheese can suddenly become vulnerable.
For decades, it was the undisputed king.
The category killer. But then this upscale brand, Goodles, hits the shelves in 2022. And according to the paper, the executives at Kraft Heinz were just notoriously slow to react, even after their own internal tests showed that, yeah, Goodles actually tasted pretty good.
And that inaction had a real measurable cost.
It really did. Kraft's market share dropped from 45% in 2022 down to 39%.
That's a huge slice of the market to lose.
It is.
Yeah.
And in that same time, Goodles, which markets itself as this healthier protein-packed version, grabbed 6% of the market. Just came out of nowhere.
The paper suggests this vulnerability goes back further to a corporate decision made years ago. The 2015 merger and this thing called the 3G model. For our listeners, what exactly is 3G zero-based budgeting?
It's a really aggressive form of budgeting. Basically, managers have to justify every single dollar of their spending from scratch every year, rather than just tweaking last year's budget.
So it's all about cutting costs.
To the bone. After the merger, it saved billions by closing plants and laying people off, but it also led to these deep systemic cuts in things like R&D, product upgrades, and marketing.
The long-term investments.
Exactly. So they knew their mac and cheese wasn't the cheesiest anymore. They knew they needed to upgrade it. But they were paralyzed for years arguing over how much it would cost. And right at that moment, Goodles pounced.
So now they're trying to play catch up. What's the fix?
Well, they're finally spending the money. They've boosted the cheese content, launched new flavors like jalapeno and ranch, and they're committing a massive $60 million to boost the brand in 2026. They're desperately trying to win back those younger, higher-income shoppers.
And this whole market struggle, it connects perfectly to another cultural trend on page one, doesn't it? The sushi shift.
It's a fascinating counter-narrative. We're seeing parents struggling with what they call their children's sushi obsession.
The anecdotes are amazing. A parent spending $150 a week on sushi for her 8- and 6-year-olds.
Exactly. These are kids with increasingly refined and expensive palates. So why is Gen Alpha demanding raw fish instead of, you know, the mac and cheese of their parents' childhood?
Well, part of it's health, I imagine.
That's part of it. Parents know it's a more balanced meal. But the bigger drivers seem to be about perceived maturity and aesthetics. The kids like the presentation, the conveyor belts at restaurants, the fact that it's adult food. It makes them feel grown up.
And there's data to back this up.
Oh, yeah. Retail sushi sales hit $2.9 billion through November of 2025. That's up 7%. It's a real quantifiable trend.
Okay, before we move on to policy, let's just quickly frame the markets. First trading day of the new year, Friday, January 2nd. What was the mood?
It was mixed, which I think reflects all these tensions we've been talking about. The S&P 500 was up a little, 0.2%. The Dow rose 0.7%.
So resilience in the traditional sectors.
Right. But the NASDAQ, which is heavy on tech and those EV stocks we were just discussing, it actually fell slightly. So it suggests that while the overall economy has momentum, investors are definitely grappling with these big sector-specific headwinds.
That's a perfect context for where we're going next, into the deep policy-driven issues facing the country.
Let's do it.
Moving from those global markets, let's focus inward. Because there's a huge, unavoidable domestic fight on the horizon, and it involves every single person listening, the Social Security insolvency cliff.
It is absolutely urgent. The clock is ticking down to a very specific date. Late 2032.
Late 2032, what happens then?
That's when the program's reserves and its incoming tax revenue won't be enough to pay full benefits anymore. If Congress does nothing, an automatic across-the-board benefit cut gets triggered. Revenue will only cover about 3/4 of what's been promised.
And that date has moved up, hasn't it? I thought it was further out.
It has. It was projected for early 2033. The pandemic accelerated things, more people retired early, and, critically, the 2025 Republican tax law also had an effect on how benefits are taxed. The system has been running in the red since 2021.
The paper makes it clear that there are no easy fixes left. The last big fix was in 1983.
Right, and that staved off insolvency for 75 years. But now, as one expert in the piece says, we've already absorbed most of the cost of waiting. The options left on the table are all politically painful.
So let's break them down. On the revenue side, the big target is the payroll tax cap. Right now, it's capped at $184,500.
Correct. And if you just eliminated that cap entirely, you'd solve about half the long-term problem.
But there's a more controversial proposal, right? To tax earnings above $250,000, but without giving those high earners any extra benefits in return. That changes the whole nature of the program.
It really does. That's the existential part of this debate. Social Security was always built on an insurance principle. You pay in, you get more back. If you start taxing high earners without giving them a corresponding benefit increase, you're shifting it away from an insurance program and more toward a pure wealth redistribution program.
Which is why it's so politically divisive, even though it would fix about 2/3 of the shortfall.
Exactly. It's a fundamental architectural change.
So what about the other side of the ledger? Reducing promised payments, the third rail of American politics.
Well, the options there focus on reducing payouts for higher earners. One idea is to change the cost of living adjustments. Instead of giving everyone the same percentage increase, the top quarter of earners would get the same dollar increase as lower earners.
And that would make a dent.
A small one. It closes about 10% of the shortfall. The other big politically explosive option is, of course, raising the retirement age again. It's currently 67.
The desperation seems to be bipartisan. Senator Lindsey Graham is quoted saying, "Everything has to be on the table."
It has to be. Age adjustments, means testing, you name it. The math is just brutal.
Okay, let's shift from domestic fiscal policy to global trade. President Trump's war on free trade is now almost 9 months old. The fear was a total collapse of global commerce.
But that's not what happened. The system has been Well, recast, it's incredibly resilient. Despite these historic tariffs, global trade volumes are expected to finish 2025 up 2.4%.
As one executive in the story puts it, trade will find its way. It's like water.
It's a perfect analogy. The water's just finding new, sometimes trickier routes.
So who are the immediate winners in this new environment?
Well, Mexico has been an unexpected winner, with imports to the U.S. way up, and Vietnam's a huge one. Their exports to the U.S. grew 42% as companies scrambled to get out of China.
The story of the clothing factory in Ho Chi Minh City illustrates that perfectly.
It does. Paul Norris's factory was just inundated with calls from American brands. Now he's in this tricky spot of trying to meet all this new demand while U.S. tariffs on Vietnam are also going up.
And there are also some very specific domestic winners, too.
Absolutely. The U.S. shrimp industry, especially shrimpers in Louisiana like James Blanchard, they are cheering these tariffs.
Because the tariffs hit their biggest competitors.
Exactly. Indian shrimpers got hit with a massive 50% tariff. So U.S. domestic shrimp prices shot up from 87 cents a pound to $1.25. The Blanchards saw their sales jump over 50%. They called it an economic lifeline.
But let's contrast that with the losers, the ones getting squeezed.
And the squeeze happens in these really complex, unexpected ways. So Indian shrimpers are losing out to countries like Ecuador. But look at a French furniture company, Gautier.
What happened to them?
The U.S. tariffs on China meant Chinese factories suddenly flooded Europe with cheap furniture, squeezing Gautier on its own home turf in France. They can't compete on price anymore, so they're pivoting to higher-end projects like hotels.
And what about U.S. manufacturers who are stuck in the middle, the ones who need to import raw materials?
That's the painful irony, isn't it? Rick Huther, who owns a company that makes tin cookie containers, he got hit with $12 million in added tariff costs in 2025.
$12 million on imported tin-plated steel.
Right. And he has to import it because U.S. suppliers can't make what he needs. He had to raise his prices twice, and he lost business to cheaper paper and plastic alternatives. He's caught.
It seems like forcing trade into these less efficient routes has to be baking in some long-term inflation.
That's the core economic question. The system hasn't collapsed, but it's definitely less efficient and more costly. It's a hidden drag on growth, and it's forcing companies to get incredibly creative just to survive.
The paper mentions this above-board playbook from a lawyer in Seattle.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's all about finding legal ways to reduce the declared value of imported goods to lower the tariff bill. For example, instead of paying a Chinese factory a fee to use their injection mold, which would be part of the product's value.
The U.S. company just buys the mold separately.
Exactly. That one-off purchase isn't part of the import's declared value, so the tariff on the final product is lower. It just shows the lengths these companies are going to.
Okay, moving back to domestic issues, we have several pretty serious political and criminal developments to cover. Let's start with the January 6th pipe bomb suspect.
Right. A federal judge refused to grant pretrial release for Brian J. Cole Jr. He's charged with planting those two pipe bombs outside the DNC and RNC headquarters on the eve of the riot.
And prosecutors say he confessed.
He did. He said he hoped they would detonate and make news because he believed the 2020 election was stolen. The judge concluded he was just too much of a danger to the public to be released. He's facing up to 30 years.
And in a separate, equally disturbing case, a terror plot was stopped in Charlotte.
Yeah, this was an 18-year-old Burger King worker named Christian Sturdivant. He was charged with trying to provide material support to ISIS.
And he had a specific plan for an attack.
A very specific one. He was planning an attack on New Year's Eve targeting Jews, Christians, and LGBTQ individuals with hammers and knives. He told an undercover officer he hoped to kill at least 11 people. The unsettling part is the FBI had apparently been tracking him since he was 14.
Just incredible. Let's pivot to the political economy now. In California, where a new tax proposal is threatening a billionaire exodus.
That's exactly what it is. The proposal is a wealth tax on billionaires. It would be retroactive to January 1st, and proponents say it could raise $100 billion to help with looming Medicaid cuts.
But the opposition is fierce, and it's not just lobbying, it's actual capital flight.
It's active relocation. Peter Thiel's firm has moved its offices to Miami. David Sachs's firm has moved founders to Austin. Even Governor Newsom opposes it. They're threatening litigation, arguing it would cause huge market instability if they have to liquidate big chunks of their businesses just to pay the tax.
And that threat of an exodus leads perfectly to the counter-narrative from the Midwest, where affordability is drawing people in.
The Midwest is suddenly winning that affordability game. The median home price there is around $319,000, which is way below the national median of over $400,000. And wage growth there has been climbing more steadily.
Appleton, Wisconsin is the case study here.
It's the perfect example. You have a couple moving from LA, selling their starter home for twice what they paid for a huge new house in Appleton. The husband keeps his $180,000 remote job, and their standard of living just skyrockets.
But there's a counterpoint, isn't there? The locals are starting to feel the pressure.
That's the crucial context. Longtime residents are getting worried about being priced out. One guy who bought his house in 2019 for $138,000 says he's frustrated. He's seeing all this new competition, grocery prices are still high, and he's not feeling the things are great narrative.
Let's stay in the Midwest and turn to Minnesota, where a massive welfare fraud scandal is dogging Governor Tim Walz.
This is being described as the nation's largest COVID-era scheme. Over 90 people have been charged, mostly connected to a nonprofit called Feeding Our Future.
And they were exploiting a child nutrition program.
Exactly. And a federally funded program meant to feed vulnerable kids. The estimates of how much was stolen range from over $200 million to potentially billions across several different programs.
And this is becoming a huge political weapon against Governor Walz.
Oh, absolutely. Republicans are using it to challenge Minnesota's whole reputation for good governance and Minnesota nice. They're painting the administration as incompetent.
How has Walz responded?
Well, he's acknowledged it. He said, "This is on my watch. I am accountable." He's hired a former FBI agent to lead fraud prevention. But politically, the damage is there. Polls show him split 48-48 on approval, and over two-thirds of voters say he needs to do more to stop the fraud.
It's going to be a tough re-election fight for him.
It certainly is.
Okay, let's transition to the global stage, starting with Iran, where economic protests are spreading.
The protests started with traders in Tehran's bazaar, but they've spread to at least 32 cities now. And the root cause is a complete economic collapse.
Driven by the currency.
The currency has crashed. The Rivers has lost 60% of its value against the dollar since the war with Israel started in June. Food inflation hit 64%. It's a crisis.
And the political root of all this is the nuclear program and the sanctions?
Exactly. Iran's refusal to compromise on its nuclear program has led to these crippling sanctions. They can't access most of their foreign reserves. They can't export oil legally. It's created a pressure cooker.
And President Trump's threat to intervene if protesters are killed was, well, it was immediately used by the regime.
Of course. He said, "We are locked and loaded and ready to go."
Yeah.
The hardliners immediately used that to paint the protesters as foreign agents. The editorial board points out there are other, more targeted things he could do, like helping with strike funds or tightening sanctions on their shadow oil fleet.
Okay, moving to Ukraine, a big leadership shift there.
A very significant one. President Zelensky has tapped his military intelligence chief, Lieutenant General Kirilo Budanov, to replace his top political aide, who resigned amid a corruption investigation.
And Budanov has a reputation for being aggressive.
Very much so. He's known for running these daring raids on Crimea and strikes against Russian oil refineries. Zelensky said his goal is to continue reducing Russia's economic potential. It's a clear signal.
All while Russia continues its attacks on civilians.
Right. There was a massive drone attack on Zaporizhia, and missiles hit Kharkiv, injuring 19 people, including a six-month-old baby. The brutal reality on the ground continues.
Now, let's look at Venezuela. There's a fascinating and painful split over the idea of U.S. military intervention.
It's a profound split, and it's all about risk assessment. Of the 8 million Venezuelans living in exile, 64% support U.S. military intervention. They are, as the paper says, more willing to roll the dice.
Because they have less to lose and are desperate to go home.
Exactly. But for those still in the country, it's a different story.
They don't support it.
Only 34% do. They are focused on day-to-day survival, soaring food prices, for one. And they are terrified of the messy, catastrophic aftermath of a U.S. intervention. They would be the ones dealing with the immediate chaos and casualties.
Finally, let's turn to Taiwan. The geopolitical stakes for Japan and the U.S. alliance here are just immense. It seems like Japan is fully committed to being the indispensable U.S. ally in the region.
They really have. A Chinese invasion of Taiwan would be a strategic catastrophe for Japan. Taiwan sits at this crucial maritime crossroads. If China controlled it, they could dominate strategic waterways and project power deep into the Pacific.
And geography basically forces Japan into the conflict zone.
It does. Japan's Ryukyu Islands are less than 70 miles from Taiwan. They would be right in the middle of it. So Japan has been investing billions in new bases, radar, and anti-ship missiles all along those islands.
So the U.S. is completely dependent on Japan for any kind of sustained intervention.
Massively dependent. U.S. forces would have to operate from bases in Japan, like Kadena Air Base. Without Japan, the next closest major base is Guam, which is 1,700 miles away. That's just not viable for the kind of sustained fighter operations you'd need. Japan is the buffer, and if Taiwan falls, that buffer is gone.
Transitioning to business and finance, let's talk about Berkshire Hathaway. Warren Buffett is 95, and his successor, Greg Abel, is inheriting, well, a problem most CEOs would dream of: too much cash.
A $358 billion problem, to be exact. That's how much cash and equivalents they have by the end of September. It's an astounding number.
And why is that a problem? It sounds like the ultimate security blanket.
It's a problem of opportunity cost. First, if the Fed lowers interest rates, the return on that cash falls. Second, the pile is so enormous, it's almost impossible to find suitable investments without completely changing Berkshire's strategy.
Buffett was famous for buying great companies at cheap prices.
Exactly. Elephant-sized deals. But right now, the market is historically expensive. S&P 500 companies are trading at more than 5 times their net assets. So analysts think Abel's just going to have to be patient and wait for a recession to bring prices down.
And the moment Buffett announced he was stepping down, the stock took a hit. The Buffett premium is real.
It's very real. The shares slid about 7%. That was the price investors paid specifically for his legendary skill and, his integrity. Abel is respected, but he doesn't have that same personal premium.
Let's quickly run through some other corporate updates. The EV pain seems to be spreading.
It is. Rivian also reported a decline in production and deliveries, hit by that same expiring tax credit. In retail, Saks Global CEO is stepping down ahead of an expected bankruptcy filing. More distress in luxury department stores.
And we're seeing a big clash between climate policy and the Trump administration.
Right. The Danish and Norwegian energy giants, Ørsted and Equinor, are seeking injunctions to stop the administration's order to halt all U.S. offshore wind construction. That's a huge setback for green energy.
And travel chaos over the holidays hit the airlines hard.
Big time. The end-of-year snowstorms caused over 10,000 flight delays on one day alone. Stocks like Delta Airlines fell almost 2%. It shows how quickly weather can hit the bottom line.
How about in venture capital and tech?
Well, IPO fundraising was up in 2025, which is good, but the volume and performance of those new listings disappointed investors. So a bit of a mixed bag.
And the AI arms race is not slowing down.
Not at all. Meta is buying a Singapore-based AI startup called Manice for over $2 billion. It's part of their aggressive push to compete with Google and OpenAI.
Meanwhile, in the world of athletic apparel, a fight at Lululemon and a show of confidence at Nike.
Lululemon's founder, Chip Wilson, is launching a proxy fight. He says the company is losing its cool. At the same time, Nike shares jumped over 4% after its CEO and board member Tim Cook both disclosed they'd recently bought a bunch of shares personally.
A classic move to signal confidence to the market.
A very classic move.
Let's talk about a new kind of corporate empire. Mr. Beast, Jimmy Donaldson. He's gone from a YouTube creator to a massive business with a very specific formula for success.
The scale is just staggering. The videos get 100 million views. His show Beast Games was Prime Video's most-watched unscripted show ever. And now he has Feastable Snacks, Beast Mobile.
Yeah.
It's a true empire.
What's so unique about his approach? He seems to treat content creation like an engineering problem.
That's a great way to put it. He is incredibly responsive to audience feedback. After season one of Beast Games, viewers said they couldn't connect with the 1,000 players and hated the games of chance.
So for season two,
he changed everything. He cut the players down to 200, then quickly to 25. He made the game skill-based with a strong versus smart theme. He's constantly analyzing data and iterating.
And he's even learning from old media. He consulted with Jeff Probst from Survivor.
That was a fascinating detail. Probst told him that he uses spectacle as a kind of disguise to hide something more personal. So Donaldson is now trying to learn how to get those deeper emotional stories out of his contestants to build drama. He's learning the craft.
And it's not just about the content, is it? There are ethical dimensions to his empire, too.
On the plus side, his Feastable snack line is working to source cocoa ethically and eliminate child labor. But on the other hand, his partnership with Saudi Arabia for a temporary Beastland amusement park drew a lot of criticism over their human rights record. It shows the challenges of going global.
I have to say, my favorite story in the entire paper is the one about Jim Moylan, the Ford engineer, the genius of the Moylan Arrow.
It is a beautiful story, isn't it? This guy, who died recently at 80, created one of the most ubiquitous, uncredited inventions in the world.
That little white arrow on your dashboard that tells you which side the gas tank is on?
The Moylan arrow. And he got the idea 40 years ago when he was driving a company car, pulled up to the wrong side of the pump, and just got soaked in the rain.
A moment of pure universal frustration.
And he just went back to the office and typed up a memo. He said for the minor investment involved, it would be a huge convenience for drivers. And Ford did it. It showed up on the 1989 Thunderbird.
And then everyone copied it. And he never asked for a patent or a dime?
It's not a thing. The CEO of Ford called him a disruptor, in the same vein as Henry Ford. Just someone who insisted on making daily life better. It was a true gift to the public.
Moving to the opinion section now, which opens with a really sharp critique of government spending and welfare abuse.
It does. It uses New York City's social services failures as the starting point, and then links that directly back to that Minnesota scandal we talked about earlier.
The argument being that the sheer scale of the system invites fraud.
Exactly. They point to New York City under former Mayor Eric Adams, where a mobile healthcare company with no housing experience got a $432 million no-bid contract for migrant housing.
And the audit results were just insane.
They were. An audit found that $11 million of the first $13.8 million in invoices were unsupported. This included paying for nearly 10,000 nights in empty hotel rooms. A later report found misconduct in all 51 nonprofits they examined.
So the editorial connects this to Minnesota by arguing the problem isn't just a few bad apples, it's the size of the orchard.
Right. They say the scale of government handouts acts as an open vault for scammers. They list this huge menu of Minnesota benefits, cash payments, housing subsidies, subsidized childcare, to show how vast and complex the system is.
The core critique is that this massive system, which has grown by $1.7 trillion since the pandemic, is just corrupting.
That's the argument, that it's corrupting for both the managers and the beneficiaries, and it creates these perverse incentives.
And this all provides a pretty harsh backdrop for the inaugural address of the new NYC mayor, Zohran Mamdani.
Mayor Mamdani, a socialist, said in his speech, "We will replace the frigidity of rugged individualism with the warmth of collectivism."
A powerful line.
A very powerful line. But the editorial board just slams it, arguing that this kind of rhetoric overlooks the human misery that's often caused in the name of collectivism. They suggest he should go visit the city's decrepit public housing to see the cold reality of it in practice.
Moving to the weekend interview, we have Jacob Rees-Mogg making a fascinating, almost paradoxical argument for progress.
He argues that progress is impossible without the past. He says traditions like common law and free speech didn't constrain innovation, they actually produced it. He sees conservatism as protecting the conditions necessary for progress.
And he was heavily influenced by his father's writing, which seems eerily prophetic today.
It really does. His father wrote a book on inflation in 1975 that he says perfectly explained the inevitable problem of fiat currencies, that governments will always be tempted to just print more money.
His father also wrote a book in 1997 that almost predicts Bitcoin.
The Sovereign Individual. It argued that new technologies would allow wealth to bypass governments and that cyber money controlled by private markets will supersede fiat money. Incredibly prescient.
So Rees-Mogg, despite his very traditional image, is actually a big fan of disruptive tech like Bitcoin and AI.
He is. He's fascinated by Bitcoin as a rebellion against inflation. And he uses ChatGPT to translate 15th century Latin books, calling it magnificent. He completely rejects the fear that AI is going to destroy us all.
And his American political ideal.
Alexander Hamilton. Because Hamilton understood that you had to create a strong institutional structure, the national debt, to unify the country and allow it to prosper.
Let's turn to the cultural critiques. Peggy Noonan has a powerful piece calling for a return to gallantry.
She defines gallantry as courageous style. It's a way of facing danger that involves self-discipline and treating weaker people well, often with no expectation of being repaid. And she says it's deeply countercultural today in our age of vulgar strength.
Her examples are wonderful.
They really are. Tony Curtis breaking his own wine glass to comfort Essel Merman. Captain Sullenberger walking the cabin twice after landing on the Hudson. Queen Elizabeth II maintaining her poise and doing her duty right up to the end. It's about a style of behavior that makes life better for everyone.
And then there's maybe the most revealing piece in the whole paper on how Ozempic exposed the pretense of the body positivity movement.
This one is fascinating. A psychotherapist observed that his patients felt they had to publicly say all the body positive things, but privately they were in deep distress and wanted to change. It felt risky to want to lose weight.
So the drug didn't change their values, it just gave them an out.
It allowed them to stop pretending. That's the key insight. The pressure to perform this agreement with the cultural script just dissolved once they had a quiet, medical way to achieve the change they secretly wanted all along. It exposed how often performance substitutes for real conviction in our culture.
And finally, Holman W. Jenkins Jr. argues that Trump was right to get rid of the old fuel economy rules.
He says the CAFE rules were a 50-year-old policy failure, a second-best approach that created all these perverse outcomes, like subsidizing huge, heavy EVs whose life cycle emissions were worse than the cars they replaced.
And it had real safety consequences.
It did. The push for lighter cars to meet the standards is estimated to have led to thousands of extra traffic deaths over the years. So Jenkins's ironic conclusion is that it took Donald Trump, of all people, to finally fix a policy failure that everyone knew was broken.
Let's wrap up with the absolute chaos in college football, a wholesale changing of the guard.
Chaos is the only word for it. In less than 30 hours, the sport's biggest dynasties, Ohio State, Alabama, and Georgia, all got knocked out of the playoffs. Stunned.
Alabama got embarrassed by Indiana.
38-3. Georgia lost to Ole Miss. These three powers had won 7 of the last 10 championships. It's a historic breakdown of the old order.
And there's a single structural reason for all of this, isn't there?
One common thread. The transfer portal.
Yeah.
The NCAA loosened the rules, and it completely ended the ability of the big powers to just stockpile all the best talent on their bench.
It leveled the playing field overnight.
It really did. Players who were stuck behind a star at Alabama could now transfer and start immediately at a place like Indiana. And you see it in the winning quarterbacks.
All three were transfers.
Every single one. The QB for Miami came from Georgia. Indiana's Heisman-winning QB was a former starter at Cal. And the Ole Miss quarterback, just 12 months ago, was playing Division II football at Ferris State.
That's incredible. It's made the sport genuinely unpredictable.
For the first time in a long time. It's created genuine, wonderful chaos.
This deep dive has covered so much ground. From the EV market revolution to the looming Social Security crisis and the complexities of this new, high-tariff world.
And we've also seen these fascinating cultural dynamics where these massive, complicated failures, like Berkshire's cash pile or the welfare fraud in Minnesota, all seem to come down to ignoring simple, uncomfortable truths.
That pressure to perform a consensus, whether it's the Ozempic story or the flawed CAFE policy.
It brings us right back to the genius of Jim Moylan and his fuel indicator era. His invention was a small, practical, undeniable truth that just eliminated confusion for billions of people.
So here's our final provocative thought for you to think about. The Moylan arrow solved a huge problem with one single elegant piece of information.
What massive business, political, or even personal confusion are we all just accepting today? Because the real answer feels too simple or maybe too politically uncomfortable to be true. In a world of so much noise, maybe the genius solution isn't some $7 trillion AI vision.
But in finding and implementing that one simple, practical truth that eliminates all the guesswork.
An excellent thought to end on. Thank you for joining us for this systematic deep dive into the Wall Street Journal, January 3, 2026.
Until next time, keep digging.